CliffCentral.com.
All right, it's sexual naked. That's two great words for a Monday morning. Take a big deep breath. Are you ready for the week? It's coming at you.
When did J.K. Rowling become so mouthy on Twitter, though? She, like, as soon as she was done with the book, she was like, okay, screw it, I'm just going to mouth off now.
What's she talking about?
It's not just like what you guys are talking about now over the weekend. She's often very outspoken on Twitter, which is not something you would kind of expect. I don't know how relevant she was prior to the book success.
Not at all. She was sitting in coffee shops.
She's huge outspoken. She's quite entertaining. I don't often agree with what she says, but she's entertaining.
Well, can you give us an example?
Well, obviously, she's very anti-Trump, very anti-Piers Morgan. But there's been other things. It slips my mind now. But she often has a go. Like, she'll have those opinions that are very much like retweets with emojis.
Oh, okay. I like that. I like that. I sometimes do that. I'm kind of falling out of love with Twitter in a big way, though. I'm really starting to think that other social media are the place that I'll be much happier and having fun. Facebook's still fun because you could see your friends' pictures and that kind of thing. Instagram's cool for the same reason.
But Gareth, everything evolves. This is just another evolution thing which you adapt to.
Absolutely.
That's all.
All right, well, let's get on to what we really are here for this morning. I mean, we're trying to be inspired. And there's a guy called Joey Evans who's popped by. He's going to come in and see us. This is probably one of the better stories. You know, occasionally we hear about someone who's really overcome all kinds of obstacles. And again, it's worth saying, there are a lot of us who think we've got problems. So for years, Joey dreamt of racing in the Dakar Rally and made it his goal to compete one day. That dream was shattered when at the Heidelberg Hair Scramble in 2007, he was involved in a serious crash from the start. And he smashed 12 teeth, was unconscious with head trauma, several broken ribs, and a broken back, and it damaged his spinal cord, leaving him completely paralyzed from just below his chest. He's just walked in here now like nothing's ever happened to him. The guy looks... You look like $1 million, man. Look at you. Huh?
Cheers, thanks. That doesn't feel that way all the time, but yeah.
Wow. I mean, I was just thinking about this story of yours and thinking... Maybe you were going to come in a wheelchair, or you'd come in, crutches, or you'd have a stick or something. You just waltzed in here like you like you just danced off some show. How are you?
No, I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Good, Joey. Nice to meet you. Joey Evans is our guest this morning, and we'll take your messages on WhatsApp 0797482090, or you can WeChat us, you can tweet us, whatever you prefer. What an incredible story. So can you... Before we get into that, just tell me a little bit about you. Where are you from? How did you get into all of this? I mean, what's your background?
Sure, yeah. I grew up in Kempton Park mainly, mm-hmm. and I've always loved motorbikes.
What's worse, being paralyzed or being from Kempton Park?
I can't say anything bad. They'll hunt me down. No, it was, I grew up loving bicycles, BMXs and that kind of stuff. And, I was one of six children, so a big family. And I always wanted a motorbike growing up, but it just wasn't on the card. So I actually only got my first motorbike when I was 26.
But there was obviously this need to do these adrenaline charging sports, to do these kind of adventurous things that are on the edge.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things that a lot of, some people get, some people don't.
No.
And you take a bit of flack sometimes from people who don't get it, but it's just different people.
But who would give you flack? I mean, the only danger here is to hurting yourself.
Yeah, but obviously, you have family and that kind of stuff. Oh, so there's obviously that
mom.
Responsibility.
Was it mom?
I wasn't going to say it, but come on.
So mom was the one who said, must you do these dangerous sports? Can't you just play tennis? Right?
No, but my mom's pretty supportive, but it's, it's a concern, for sure.
Well, she was right.
Yeah,
she was proven right.
That's true.
So, you like to do the slightly less safe, secure, gentle sports. You like to mess around on motorbikes. My parents always told me when I was a kid, if you get a motorbike, that's one of the two things, my dad said. One of two things. The other one is if you get piercings. He hated piercings for some reason. Like, if you get a motorbike, you get piercings, you're out. I'm never going to talk to you again. So I took that very seriously. But motorbikes can be extremely dangerous, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, it's one of those things.
Accidents all the time.
No, it is. But there's two sides of it. You know, there's that side of it, and there's the other side of the places it can take you, and the things you can go. I mean, to be able to ride through the mountains of Lesotho, and you can go places where you would never get to. It's too far to hike to. You can't get a 4x4 there. The only way to get there is on a dirt bike or a donkey over 3 weeks, you know. And so the places you see, you know, I've been up through Mozambique and Swaziland and Lesotho and Botswana and these incredible places. It's just for your soul, it's worth the price you pay sometimes.
So when you decided that you wanted to do the Dakar, I mean, that's no small feat.
Sure.
You know, that's a big goal to have. At that stage, you know, you everything was 100%. You had a plan to get there.
Yeah.
You knew what you had to do.
Yeah.
And then fate intervenes.
Yeah, it was tough when it all happened, you know. I'd seen Dakar on TV, and I love, you know, the outdoors and the kind of camping survival type stuff. And so now you mix motorbike racing with all of that, and it's like, wow, it's this perfect brew of adventure. And it was just so attractive for me, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to do that race one day. That's really the plan. But that was, at the time I had a young family, and it just wasn't on the cards financially and time-wise and things. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, I'm going to do that race. And then racing in 2007 to break my back and be paralyzed.
All right, how did that happen? I mean, can you remember? Can you actually remember it, or do other people have to tell you what happened?
Yeah, other people tell me what happened because I lost my memory for about 15 minutes worth of time.
Yeah, there was head trauma as well, right?
Yeah.
Serious head trauma.
Yeah, I was a bit of a cone head. You know, I had a lot of swelling and things for a while, but I lost the memory of that time.
So what did everybody tell you happened?
Well, we started the race. There was about 20 of us, and as we kind of all tapered in, you know, after the start, a bit of a mass start, so it's a bit of a rush for the first corner.
Yeah.
A guy rode into my swing arm, so sort of the back wheel, and in essence, you know, with racing, it's just a whole lot of like dust and wheels and stuff, and then other guys rode over me as well.
Oh my god.
And I was unconscious, and basically I woke up and saw these faces staring down at me, and so I joked a bit.
How long after that did you wake up and realize where you were and who you were?
I immediately, as soon as I woke up and I saw the faces around me, I was like, okay.
How long after the accident did you wake up?
Oh no, within probably a minute or two, you know.
Oh my God, really?
So you know, you're lying.
So
there.
You were conscious.
Yeah. And then I saw these faces staring at me, and I realized I'd been unconscious. So I joked. I was like, hey, did I win? Just kind of kidding around. And then I realized I thought I had dirt in my mouth, and I was spitting it out, and it turned out to be a lot of my teeth.
Oh my God.
And then there was somebody like next to me, and my legs were bent and leaning against them. And she stood back, and my legs just fell straight down like dead meat. And I just whispered to the paramedic. I was like, I can't feel my legs. You know, it's just nothing there. And I didn't understand what spinal cord injuries were then. You know, it was but it was best, because if you realize the path ahead, it would have just been, I think too much to bear at the time.
So what, it was between T8 and T9
that
broke your back?
Yeah.
So that means pretty much everything from below your belly button.
Yeah, yeah. As far as in terms of my stomach, basically I've got the two top muscles, but not the two bottom ones, if that makes sense.
Oh, wow.
I started off what appeared to be a complete injury, so everything gone. But with time, it turned out to be an incomplete injury. So I started to get some things back, and I had an operation to fuse my back and things, and took some pressure off the spinal cord, and then I slowly started getting things back, and I was fortunate enough to be able to learn to walk again. It was a bit of a journey.
What is it like to realize that you, in that moment, that you can't feel your legs, you can't use your legs, because you think, oh my God, this is permanent, this is forever. You didn't know that you'd get.
We were told it was permanent. I had ramps put in my house and wheelchair and all that stuff. I was in hospital.
So how were you able to come to terms with this? Because if I knew that I wouldn't be able to walk or run any of that stuff again, I think it might just make me suicidal.
Yeah, exactly that. Prior to that, you know, you mentioned that. I never really felt like I had a lot of support. So for me, I didn't really consider suicide, if that makes sense.
Mm.
But I got it. Probably for the first time in my life, I got where guys are at, where you have this feeling of zero hope, where it's like the future looks so bleak that you don't want to be there. You know, it was really, it was a dark place. And you kind of, it opened your mind a bit to realize how people get to that point.
What a miraculous thing, though, that you managed to discover it was an incomplete injury and you managed to rehabilitate yourself.
Yeah. Well,
how long did that process take?
Well, still now I don't have a lot of things. I can't feel hot, cold, or pain sensation, you know, below my chest. I still use catheters. Mm. I still get spasms. I can't run or jump. I can do a bit of a dodgy-looking jog. So there's a lot of challenges I still deal with
daily. But you take all this in a heartbeat over being stuck in a wheelchair, right?
Man, you know, to be someone dealing with a complete spinal cord injury, I can tell you now that those guys are the real heroes. Those guys, and especially the guys that wake up and are positive and keep working and strive to make the best out of their situation, those guys are just, they're worlds ahead of me.
Yeah, but you're a very positive guy. How did you get yourself through it? Because it couldn't have all been easy.
No, it isn't. And a lot of times people will say, Joe, you're awesome hero, this kind of... But there were times where you'd lie in bed at night and just cry your eyes out. It was just too much to bear. It really was. And other times, I'm cranking out the reps in physio and I'm pushing hard and I'm like, no, this ain't going to beat me. But there was highs and lows. You know, it's not always easy to be that guy that just keeps going.
You mentioned you had a young family at that stage.
Mm.
So, I mean, what was that? Wife, two kids, wife, kid? What was the story?
Four daughters.
Jesus, you didn't waste any time, huh?
Well,
wow,
you know,
four daughters.
That's it.
So you had you couldn't go anywhere. If you wanted to kill yourself, it wouldn't be possible. You've got people to look after.
No, that's it. But you need to get out. You know, you need to get away from all that girly stuff from time to time.
But did they... That's amazing that you should be on bikes the whole time and you should end up with four girls. Any of them show any interest in that kind of thing?
They enjoyed a little bit. We had a little quad bike that we had them riding on and stuff. But once they outgrew that little one, we were like, no, we're done. You know, I'm not keen to be carrying in little girls into hospital rooms.
One risk in the family is enough.
That's it. And I don't want to share my toys.
Did they play a role in you rehabilitating yourself? I mean, they must have been an inspiration to you in some way. You must have woken up in the morning and gone, I've got to do this for them, if not for me.
Yeah, huge. You know, and, you know, especially, you know, my wife, Meredith, as well. You realize that as hard as it is, you have so much to live for. And when you're negative and when you're miserable and you're kind of feeling sorry for yourself, all of that just like spreads throughout the family. But they're positive, and if you can just kind of feed off the positive, you know, energy and just keep going and keep being positive, it's an awesome environment, and you have lots to be grateful for. There's way more to be grateful for than there is to be miserable about, you know, to be angry about.
And then to start planning Dakar?
Yeah, that was...
how did you even think that was possible? Because now, basically all your dreams get put on hold when something like this happens. Everything is on pause, and you're like, oh God, now I've got to spend the next however many months or years trying to get just basic things working again.
Yeah, not even on pause. They evaporate. Everything you thought you'd do is gone. It's gone. And but I'd lay in that hospital bed right in the beginning, and I remember clearly lying there and thinking, man, if I still got to do Dakar after this, that would be cool. That would be a story. That would... And so it kind of like I had that seed in me, and it was... And as the years went by, and obviously, you know, learning to walk again, and then the first time I got on a bike again, and then, you know, after a while, I bought a second-hand bike, had all the suspension lowered so I could hold it up, and then I started racing again, and when I raced, I'd get through one lap and get time-barred, and other guys are doing six laps.
Okay, I got to ask you now, why? I mean, haven't you learned your lesson? At this point, the sensible thing to do is...
Yeah,
and I know that we're, you know, you're clearly into this, you're a junkie, but... Isn't a sensible thing to do, go, all right, I was given this amazing second chance. Like, I can use my legs again. There's certain things that I can't do, but mostly I'm way better off than I thought I would be when I first came off that bike.
Yeah.
And now you're going to take a risk and get into racing. Why not just go for rides in the Lesotho Mountains? Isn't that enough for you?
you know,
what's wrong with you?
There's lots. You can ask my wife. there's, you know, if you have a second chance, what's the point of wasting it just parking off and doing nothing and being like, cool, at least I'm safe. Let me put me out to pasture.
That is the point. Be safe. Like, you've got daughters and a wife. You've got things to worry about. You've managed to get back some of the basic faculties. Come on.
No, you'll just be a miserable guy on the couch watching TV with cheese necks on your fingers.
This is why you do what you do and I do what I do. I don't even want to leave home. You want to get out there and do the Dakar.
Exactly.
All right, so you had this dream. You thought, what the hell? Wouldn't that be a great story? And then it starts coming together.
It did, you know. And over the years, you know, I did some racing, and then I started to finish some races, and then I did some multiple day races, and then I'm like, I could do this. I could do this. And as we went along, then we started to really consider it. And so you have to qualify for Dakar. You don't just pitch up.
Yeah.
That's it. So
they don't care about your sob story, about your broken back.
They care nothing.
Do me a favor.
No, you're right. Spot on. And so then I went and did the Mazuga Rally in Morocco, and I finished that, and then I quite, so that would, you know, was enough for my CV, let's say. So I sent in the CV and said, hey guys, you know, you pay your deposit because it costs you over 100 grand for your deposit, so it's a big thing, you got to pop it in there. And I got the letter back saying, congratulations, you know, you've been accepted. And you get that letter, and you're kind of like, oh, crap, what have I done? You know, now all of a sudden it's real.
You said, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Meredith was, you know, she was suicidal at this point. Like, what the hell's wrong with this man? Tell me,
for sure.
One thing we've kind of glossed over, but it couldn't have been easy, is how do you learn to walk again? I've often thought about this. You see physiotherapists, and they've got those bars on either side, yep. And someone learns to kind of move one foot in front of the other. And yeah, when we're 1 or 2 years old, younger than one, when do kids start walking? Around one, it just happens intuitively.
Yeah,
you kind of pull yourself along on the ground, then eventually you get up and you hold on to things, and then before you know it, you're walking.
Yeah,
and this is what humans have done for years, millions of years. But it's a very difficult thing to learn in adulthood.
It's crazy because it's one of those things that you didn't appreciate before you lost it, and suddenly you realize, wow, this is a big thing. And
it's not like riding a bicycle. You can't just pick it up again.
People sometimes think that, so they'll say, when did you start walking again? And it's like, well, what would you consider walking? I mean, still now I'll catch feet and, you know, and fall on steps and, you know, fall over in the mall and that kind of stuff.
Sometimes. No, how embarrassing.
You know? Yeah, my problem are huge, but it's one of those things, you know. And but in the beginning, you have, you know, first of all, they got to stand you up because obviously with not the muscles working your legs, all the blood just drains straight from your head. And so the first time you're on a tilt table, just to be able to get you in a vertical position without passing out, you know, there's so much more that you don't even see. And then they had back slabs on my legs, which went down into your shoes with like Velcro. So it kind of holds your legs vertical, and you're basically supporting yourself on your arms between these parallel bars. And as I started to get some movement, by now all the muscles have just wasted away.
Yeah.
So even though you've got some nerves going to the muscles, and you don't have all the nerves, just a few, they're on muscles, the muscle's gone. So it took although to first get some kind of movement, you know, you can kind of move in a swimming pool with no weight on your legs and that kind of stuff, to actually have the strength to walk or to go up steps, for instance, is a huge, excuse the pun, but a huge step from walking, you know, or to bend down or to, you know, and it's core as well, which also affects it. So it was a long time, but it went from...
How do you get those muscles back up and running?
Just by, you know, first you need the connection between your brain and that muscle. That's the first thing. And it's not like it's on or off. There's varying degrees because you've got a whole bunch of nerves going to your quad. And like still now I don't have, like even if I work my quads as hard as I want, they'll never be as strong as a normal quad, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So there's a lot of... It's a lot of time, and so once you start getting those first kind of nerves, you can kind of flex it, but you can't move your leg. So
so
you work on that flexing, you work on the flexing until you get a bit of movement without any load bearing, without any weight on it, and then you work up to little bits of weight, and you work it up more and more until you finally get to the point where you can move it under gravity, if that makes sense. And it's a long process.
It's gradual.
Very, very gradual. And sometimes I got to the point where I'm like, it's not getting any better. We're not
getting anywhere. Yeah, you get impatient, right?
Yeah. But then my wife will say, look at this. Do you remember where you were in March or in February? Do you remember when you couldn't even do that? And then you're like, yeah, you're right. You know, that was. And
she's
so then
a superstar.
Oh, more than you know.
Huh?
No, it's true.
I mean, to put up, any other woman would have just left you alone and said, "Ah, well,
I was going to say,
don't
tell her how good she is. She'll leave, you know."
Yeah, we're trying
to keep that a secret.
See, some people will say, and I've seen this because, you know, I work with some people who've got head injuries as part of, you know, what I do to kind of bring awareness to their hard work at Headway. And I think about the families more than I do the victims sometimes. You know, you were the victim of this crash, but in essence, it becomes everybody else's problem.
Exactly that.
And they didn't ask for the problem, and it takes its toll on them almost more than on you because
in a big way.
They're not allowed to feel sorry for themselves. They're just there to support you. They can't let the curtain down and then you see them crying the whole time. It's going to make you feel worse, and then you're not going to get better.
Spot on. It really is hard. And that's with any injury. You know, people have, even cancer or any kind of thing. Mm. It is. It's everybody around them. But that's kind of the beauty of families and the beauty of friends is that now in the position I am, you see other people go through stuff and you all kind of rally around that person and you see them succeed and that success is part of your success. So that's, you know, for me, I was, you know, hugely blessed to have the family and the friends that I have and that I had at that time. Really, they make all the difference. They really do.
So what can't you do at the moment?
Play the piano.
No, you couldn't do that before.
No, that's true.
Please.
But, well, it's not about what I can't do really, but what I, you know, like I said, my legs don't work properly. So I can walk, but I can't run. And I used to play lots of soccer and volleyball and skates and all that sort of stuff. So all of that's gone.
Is there any chance you'll be able to be to do that stuff again?
In my mind, yeah, for sure. You know, you can't say can't. You know, the way science is going as well. But generally with spinal cord injuries, you know, you get back in the first year or two from a nerve point of view, and that's what you've got. So for me, I can improve fitness and muscles and that kind of stuff, but you have this kind of limiting factor of the damage on the spinal cord.
Yeah, and those nerves can't communicate with nerves that have been severed.
That's it.
You know, that's,
or crushed,
it's just,
or
it's
yeah.
done.
Yeah,
it's over and
as it is right now. But but we see things moving along, and so
sure, you never
you
know.
Can't say never. You know, and that's something I've got to just mention. You know, in the beginning, when I first had this injury, it's such a dark place, and people are telling you never. You know, they said 10% chance you walk again, and if you do, it's going to be badly with AIDS and that kind of stuff. And here we are now, 10 years later, so it's a huge amount of time, but being able to race the Dakar. So it's like you can never say when those guys are in that really dark place, as much as – and the doctors were right, you know, in terms of this is what we found with other patients over time. But the reality is – so much can happen in life, and you don't allow yourself to be held down by that. You know, dream, you know, yeah, and do aim
get,
for that.
Do you get annoyed with people who say I can't?
Oh man, I love it when guys say, yeah, that's nice, but it's you're not going to be able to do that. You just need someone to say that. When someone says you can't, you're like, ooh, yeah, that's what I want you to say. You know?
Yeah, I see. This is why I'm not you, and why I suppose you're a better person, because I'd be going around telling people, yeah, screw you. You can't? Oh, you big pussy. Let me tell you what I've done. You know? That's probably why I'm not in that position. All right, so can you jump?
About a centimeter.
Okay, and is there a lot of pain still?
Yeah, there is a lot of pain, but it's not like it used to be, so it's not excessive, but yeah, there's pain.
And you said you have catheters?
Yeah, I self-catheter.
So peeing has got to be horrible.
Oh, it is. And you do that in a rally environment, in the bivouacs.
Oh,
and
God.
You know, it is. I self-catheter, so what it is to be perfectly frank, I can hold urine, but I can't release properly, if that makes sense.
So you have to stick this tube into your penis.
There you go.
Jesus. the pain. And the bowels, the asshole?
Yeah.
That works?
Semi, let's say, you know.
Oh, my God.
So if we're gonna be graphic, you can't knape properly.
Yeah.
So when nature calls, it shuts.
So in other words, you know that there's a shit coming.
Yep.
You have to make sure that you can get to a bathroom far quicker than I do. I can't hold it. I can hold it in. You can't hold it in.
Well, I hold it in a little bit, and it's got better over the years, but it's
so
pretty
many
much
times,
that.
How many times in a day?
Well, you got to kind of work out some good timing, because you take medication to help you digest food and stuff.
Right.
So you kind of play this delicate
balance.
As you
said, your stomach doesn't really know what it's doing.
Yeah. So you kind of play this delicate balance, and there's nothing more of a delicate balance than balancing laxatives with bowel control. So
what
it's a bit of a recipe for disaster. disaster, but we get through, you know, and I had an occupational therapist right in the beginning, and to talk frank about this stuff, they, you know, it's hard, you know, but with them talking,
sorry, are you all right over there?
So, but she said to me, she said, you know, because I was worried, I didn't want to go places, didn't want to do stuff and things, because you're always worried, and she said, you mustn't care what happens. Don't worry about what other people think. Don't worry about that kind of stuff. Just get out there and live your life. And that was the best advice that I had. And so all of this kind of stuff, at first it's hard to talk about and it's difficult, but there's thousands of people dealing with much worse. And so get on with your life
and, you know,
and
what?
Live.
If that's the worst thing,
oh, bring it.
Yeah, bring it, exactly. Yeah. So how about sex with the wife?
Well, yeah, there's challenges, but we're sorted, you know, so it's a lot better now.
It works?
Yeah, we're good now.
Thank God. Thank goodness. I was very worried for her. I mean, it's the only consolation.
Yeah, we won't be having any children though, but it would be a bit
of
a miraculous.
Well, you've got four. What are you talking about?
Oh, come on, it's a talent. You got to use it.
It's, but, like, it's almost like it was ordained beforehand that you had these four girls.
Well, I had four children, and my wife was 26 and I was 28 when we had four children already, but, and the accident happened at 32, so we're super grateful that it worked out that way.
That's kind of, you know, it's a very interesting message almost from the universe that you've got four girls.
Fantastic.
They were all
girls
sorted out before this accident happened,
because
you wouldn't have been able to have more. But, you know, you still, everything functions there, so you don't have to be boring your wife to death.
There you go.
There we go. Wow, man, what a story. I'm very impressed. I think this is terrific. I think there are lots of people who will take huge inspiration from this. Have you been offered books and movies and all kinds of things?
Not all that. We've done a lot of, obviously, publicity now since coming back, a lot of interviews and stuff, which is really cool and a bit intimidating.
When did you get back?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Had a good one?
Very good. But it was, I mean, Dakar itself, there's stories of Dakar, you know, there's some huge challenges there, you know.
Tell me.
The biggest one without it, well, it was one where I tore some ligaments in my knee on the fourth day of 13. But on day 12 of 13, the second last day, my bike was ridden over by a car, where the car came down behind me, and I tried to get out the way. I couldn't get out the way. It was a deep rut I was in, and I dropped the bike, rolled out the way, and the car was so close on me, he just went, whoa, straight over the bike, and just totaled this bike, you know, ripped, you know, flattened the whole exhaust, bent it all into the back wheel, took off the right foot peg, you know,
I lost almost all my...
Oh, yeah, and if I'd fallen the other way, he would have gone over me, because I would have fallen into the track, and it was crazy, and but it was over, and I called my wife on the sat phone there.
Couldn't he have slowed down and stopped?
Oh, this, I promise you, you have no idea the craziness that's out there in those dunes and in the desert. And yeah, he should have. We've got sentinels on our bikes that go off when a car's behind you. But the bottom line is that I was out this race. I had 3 liters of petrol left in the bike because I damaged all the tanks. I had no navigation. All my bars are bent and skew, no foot peg. The bike won't start, the exhaust all flattened. And I phoned my wife on the
sat phone. He drove over this useless piece of shit.
So, no, you're right over the bike, not me. But
that's what I'm talking about. I wouldn't call you a useless piece of shit. I just told everyone how inspirational you were.
So, but what I did is I took the exhaust off. And, well, before, I phoned my wife and I was like, look, you're not going to see me up on the track because she's following, getting less sleep than me. And I knew she'd be worried. And I phoned her. I said, look, I think I'm out of this race. And I hung up that phone. And, you know, we both had a bit of a cry, to be honest. And because it's all this work and it's all gone. And then I took the exhaust off the bike and I straightened up the bars as best I could, and I had 3 liters of petrol. I wasn't going to get to the next point of petrol, so I was out the race. But I just said, you know what? I'm not going to be sitting here in the felt when that sweeper truck comes. I'm not going to be that guy. I'm going to be moving. Even if it's 100 meters from here, I'm going to be moving when they pick me up. And I zigzagged that bike through the felt for probably 10 or 15 Ks, just knowing I'm a dead man walking. And then I found another bike, exactly the same as mine, a KTM rally replica. The guy had broken his arm. He'd been air-vacked out of there, and his bike was there.
Poor him. Did you grab his bike with both hands?
Can I tell you, I told you earlier I was from Kempton, so you know what I did. So I stripped that exhaust. I siphoned all the petrol out of his bike. I took his whole foot peg cradle, and we popped it all on my bike, and I rode another 660 Ks on that bike, finished at 2:10 in the morning. got an hour sleep, rode another 800 k's the final day, and we finished the Dakar. So,
Dude, well done.
And so it was just, it was, we were at whatever we took, whatever it took stage, whatever it took, we were all in.
That's amazing. What a story. Where was the, where was all this action that in these last couple of k's?
Argentina. Yeah, I was up in Argentina.
Hostile place in some places, huh?
Oh, it's just, you know, where the, all that happened was just, it was just bare. There was just nothing there. Yet, and it's crazy.
Where
it's,
is that? Like in the south in Tierra del Fuego?
Oh, geez. It was, for me, it was just dirt and sleep and eat and ride.
You didn't care about the map.
That was it. You weren't really following. But it was, we were finishing up in Buenos Aires on the final day. So I was somewhere about 1,200 Ks from Buenos Aires, I guess.
I think that's amazing. You, here's a dream that you've turned into reality, a dream that was completely unlikely.
Yeah. No, it was really just, and there were times that I didn't even believe it was possible. But slowly as I ticked away at the little goals each year, a little bit closer, and suddenly you're standing on the threshold of, you know, standing at that start line at Dakar, man, those emotions were just right there. You can't believe that this is it, this is here, you know?
It's phenomenal. And you must have obviously had lots and lots of people tell you, well, we can't believe this. But the fact is, you probably couldn't have believed it.
No, you're right. And I mean, there's so many other things. Like, we had to raise 1.1 million rand to be able to pay for it, to be on that start line. And we managed to raise that 1.1 in 7 months.
Unreal.
You know, who does Unreal. That, you know? Oh, well. And so just with all the help, and we did all sorts of stuff, fundraiser days, and we sold caps and T-shirts, and I did some, you know, some speaking at companies, and, you know, whatever it took, we were all in. Whatever it took,
Amazing.
We had to do all these little things on the way. So it was money, it was physical, it was time, it was so much, you know, but to be there was great.
And what about the next goal? Because you're obviously the kind of person who progresses from one thing to the next. You mentioned earlier this gradual thing of learning to walk again, learning to do all kinds of things again that you weren't able to do when you started this process. So once you've done the Dakar, what's the next big goal?
You know, I don't think it's anything.
Are you finally going to sit at home and eat chips and do nothing?
No, we're definitely not going to do that. But you know, like, you, I guess also when you achieve something like this, you kind of makes you realize that you don't have to just drive your car and sit on the highway and go to work every day and just do that, the same old stuff that everyone's been telling you your whole life you got to do and things. And so, you know, I want to try different
but hang
things.
On, most of us do, Joey. Most of us are like that, and we're okay with it. Not all of us are as mad as you are.
But no, I want to do different things now. And so, like, something I want to do now for the next little while is share the story, you know, and do some motivational speaking and things. And I've done some leading up to it, and I love it. You know, I love to be able to share people or share with people the thing, because for me, when I was there 10 years ago lying in the hospital, it was the worst possible thing that can happen to me. Yeah. And now people come up to me and they say, oh, you're lucky, you got this cool story. I want to be, are you kidding me? I want to hit you in the face with a chair, you know? It's not lucky. This was terrible.
Yeah.
But it is a cool story, and a lot of people are having that cool story, but they are at chapter one, and it is miserable, and they don't realize that they can change this into this really cool story.
Well, here's Angela, who says, I'm so inspired by his story. Flip, his attitude and perspective challenged me. So there we go. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about.
Oh, you know, it is. And I've, you know, you hear that kind of stuff a lot, and it's just, it lets you know that you're not all that crazy, that there is some good coming from this. So you see.
Look, you could still rather do sensible, safe things. I'm hell-bent on this idea.
Yeah.
For the sake of your wife and kids, for God's sake, stop all this nonsense.
No. Look, as far as Dakar goes, when I was there, I said, there is no ways I'm coming back. You know, from a point of view of it, it was that dangerous, and your life is like hanging in the balance every day. And it makes you realize that, man, you know, this is crazy. What am I doing here?
Any embarrassing shitting stories from the Dakar?
Oh, there was a couple close ones, but luckily we made it in the nick of time. Let's just put it that way.
Well, it must have been a unique set of challenges for you too, because you obviously had different medical requirements and different kind of you needed certain kinds of medication, and it's not to say that you were being followed by a team of doctors, but there must have been some challenges in that respect.
You work it out over the years, you know, and I know you like to be pretty frank and stuff, and so it is. When you're in those environments and you're sleeping in those environments and stuff, you work out how to use catheters and cool drink bottles and you know all sorts of stuff.
You have to make a plan.
You know, so you do that. You do, and I've ridden rallies before and stuff, and so you've kind of worked out all these plans along the way, and so yeah. You make a plan and you make it work in that environment no matter what it takes.
Well, man, I'm thrilled to meet you. I'm delighted to hear that you've done so well, and welcome back 3 weeks ago. Welcome back to civilization.
There you go.
And to, you know, family and friends and happy things, not this mad Dakar rally. But listen, in all sincerity, the story to me is... It's phenomenal how far you've come and how much you've got done. And I think that this is precisely the story that must be shared with so many people. Because there are people out there who are looking for reasons to feel sorry for themselves. There are lots of people out there who probably have it better or worse, but who imagine that it's hopeless.
Yeah.
And if your story can help them get some hope going, then that's the tiny little spark that might ignite a flame. And then their lives can come back in full force.
Yeah,
You don't feel like you've lost anything in terms of where you're at now. You'd rather be here now as you than not be here.
Absolutely. And you look back and you think like, man, you know, living through spinal cord injuries and having this adventure and doing that, one day, you know, you're going to lie there on your deathbed and think, man, that was a good ride. You know, we kind of experienced the full palette.
Well, you have, and thank you for being so inspiring about it and sharing your story with us. There we go, everybody. Joey, very big pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
And we will have this and all the other podcasts up on cliffcentral.com in a short while. Wrapping it up for this morning, we're going to come back with the un-news, and then we're out of here, leaving you with belated Ben Sport and plenty of other good stuff today. Yeah, riding dirty. Chameleonaire, there's another one CS says that we must check out. Where are they now?
Chameleonaire is actually trying to be a chabillionaire now.
Oh, really?
He's a venture capitalist now.
Oh, really?
Working with Upfront Ventures based in LA. So look at him, actually. He's a positive Where Are They Now.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Not like poor old Blue Cantrell.
Say, what happened to
girl? We covered this last week.
Gosh, okay.
Poor Blue Cantrell.
Breakdown, getting into hospital.
And it all came about that discussion because of old Misha Barton, who's clearly spun out as well.
Well, not everyone can handle celebrity, eh?
No.
It's not for everyone.
Not everyone can handle life. Life is tough.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of shit to deal with.
Oh, come on. But when you hear our guest, then you're like, okay.
What's your excuse?
Let me get my
stuff
in order.
Huh? Joey Evans. I mean, basically, he couldn't walk. He couldn't use any part of his body below his belly button.
Imagine.
Now he's walking. You saw him. He strode in here like he's never had a problem in his life. I love it. It's beautiful to see.
That's when you really recognize that everything is a decision at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You decide how you're going to react to it.
Attitude.
Meow.
And sometimes you've got the right attitude, sometimes not. All right, so we're on tomorrow. Valentine's Day special. Fabio makes his return. I will be live in Cape Town. The rest of the team will be here in studio. And you must share your celebrity crushes with us, because we're going to be doing that with you. We're going to have our poems that we've dedicated to our celebrity crushes. Right, Mubs?
That's right.
You can have three if you want, but I think you should zone in on one. And I have a feeling I know who yours is.
Oh, do you?
I think I do. I'm going to write it down like Gilan Gork does and put it in an envelope and leave it here for you tomorrow.
All right, and then we'll open the envelope before I read my poem.
Excellent. All right, thank you for joining us this morning. We love radio and excited to be hosting a dialogue on cliffcentral.com on World Radio Day. That is the Consciousness Cafe, ladies. They're on this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Don't miss that. Don't miss the rest of the lineup today. Ben has got the Bounce Show today. Ben, what will you be covering?
Well, Gareth, Super Rugby is coming up. So, you know, always trying to find ways to get people involved and be positive about rugby. After last week's positive show, this week we're doing Super Brew. And I chat with one of the top guys from there, from London.
Okay.
And, of course, just wrapping up the sport in more depth.
How long does Super Rugby last? It starts now and it ends in what, September?
August.
Jesus. Yeah. It's a bit long, right?
It's
just a little. Isn't that a bit long?
Yeah, it's just a little bit, Shem.
Feels like it should be max 4 or 5 months. Not several thousand.
I mean, those guys aren't doing Pilates when they get onto the field every time, you know?
No, exactly.
Like hardcore stuff.
No, the careers are getting shorter.
The Grammys have just taken place and Adele scooped a whole bunch of awards as expected. What wasn't expected is that she had no idea Beyonce was pregnant. During an acceptance speech, a generously sized singer praised Beyonce for having the confidence to put on a show despite having put on a few pounds during the winter.
Generously sized.
Yeah, generously sized. J.K. Rowling is still feeling very smug about his spat with Piers Morgan that the left ruled as a giant success. She is this week's Echo Chamber Queen and is now a nominee for the Meryl Streep Smugness Award at the upcoming Oscars. We can't wait for that. Orlando Pirates finally have called a press conference this morning on the back of their 6-0 thrashing to Sundowns, and their fans are ruining the game by invading the pitch, so they've got to talk about it. Ivan Koza says he's going to urge the press not to expect too much. He basically just wants people to come together to praise his greatness and therefore forget that Saturday ever happened. And Supersport will help him do that. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company of cliffcentral.com. Anything else here? Did I leave anything out?
Yes, nope.
I did.
Oh.
I did.
You did?
Oh, yes. Let me quickly tell you about this. On Thursday, it's our exclusive screening of The Cure for Wellness. Did you see The Ring? Do you remember that movie?
Oh, this sounds just like the kind of movie Sia will like.
No, I think Sia will be very afraid. Afraid. So very afraid.
I'll gladly watch the teasers before the movie.
This is terrifying. It's really very, very scary. It's one of those thrillers. So, A Cure for Wellness launches in theaters across South Africa on Friday the 17th of February, but we're seeing it first on Thursday. I'm not sure if there are any tickets left for this exclusive Cliff Central preview, but if you're in Joburg and you want to join us, just email events@cliffcentral.com and you may just be lucky. It's about an idyllic but mysterious wellness center at a remote location in the Swiss Alps. Guess what? The spa's miraculous treatments are not what they seem. It's a curious illness that keeps all the guests here longing for a cure. You don't want to miss this. It sounds dodge, and it is. All right, make sure that you don't miss it.
Just bring an extra set of diapers.
events@cliffcentral.com is the email address to send that to. All right. We shall see you tomorrow. Excellent. CliffCentral.com.